Welcome to another Mormon Expression Voices. I'm Flip. I'm hosting today. Continuing on, I don't know, the Believer series, I've got another different story. My old friend now, Pastor Mark Peach.
Hello.
And I wanted to have Pastor Mark on because I guess I met you because you hung out at the coffee shop that I hang out at. And at some point, we started talking religion. Very quickly, I realized that you were an extra special fun pastor to talk to because you would actually talk to me when I'd ask my obnoxious theological questions, which I'm sure you remember some of them.
I do. Not too obnoxious.
Because most of them were kind of silly, really like meta stuff, not gotcha type theological questions. But what if this was true, then how would this work type theological questions? But then the other thing that was so interesting is that I found out that you were born and raised in Layton.
Yeah, that's correct.
And lived there pretty much your whole life other than going off to seminary, right?
I lived about 15 years in the Midwest. After I moved away from Layton and went to college in the University of Nebraska, I moved to Chicago from there and lived in Indiana and spent about 15 years in the Midwest before moving back.
So you did high school and all of that in Layton?
I did. I went to Layton High.
So, I mean, you must have been able to count the other non-Mormons in Layton, right?
Yeah, well, I knew a good amount of non-Mormons. With Layton being so close to Hill Air Force Base, there were a lot of my friends were non-Mormons, actually.
Both of your parents were religious too, right?
Yes, they grew up going to a Protestant church, and I grew up going to a Protestant church in Clearfield, an interdenominational church.
Were your parents from Utah?
My parents are originally from Lincoln, Nebraska.
Okay.
And they came here in the 1960s to Utah.
So, I mean, that must have been, even back then, pretty wild coming to Layton, of all places, being a non-Mormon.
Yeah, it was a very different experience for them.
Did the family catch any flack from the Mormons?
I don't know if it was really flack that they caught. I think they noticed a difference of how they might have been treated when someone found out that they weren't Mormon. But I don't think it was anything harsh or anything completely, you know.
The common thing that you hear from like non-Mormon kids growing up in Utah, sometimes there's a thing where, like, there's that particular family down the street. The Mormon family said, you know, their kids can't play with you, you know. They would kind of lock people out. And sometimes it was, you know, expressly. Sometimes, you know, mostly they'd do it kind of, you know, just under the table, as it were. Just, you can't hang out with those guys. But sometimes, you know, it was people are told, like, I don't want you hanging out with my kids because you're not Mormon or whatever.
Yeah, my parents didn't really experience too much of that. I remember my sister had an experience like that with one of her friends that was LDS that, you know, when she was a kid, wasn't invited to her birthday party, that kind of thing. But nothing too major other than, like, an incident here and there.
See, that's interesting because anecdotally, when I ask people this question, like, I've got particularly a friend and his little sister, and I ask him about his experiences with the Mormons growing up, and he was just like, oh, the Mormons are all right. And I asked the sister, and she'd say the girls are evil, horrible, rotten people. And I've heard from more than one person that the Mormon girls, and maybe it's just teenage cattiness or something like that, but it seems to be the way. So, like, did you associate? Did you have lots of Mormon friends? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I had a good amount of Mormon friends. I'd say most of my close friends weren't LDS, but I had some that were.
And did anybody try to proselytize to you?
A little bit here and there.
Did you try to proselytize back?
Well, at the time, I didn't. My faith journey has, you know, I really didn't express faith in Christ until I was a senior in high school. So, like, my early years, I really didn't, I don't think I proselytized back, you know, just kind of, well, I guess in a secular kind of way, probably.
Yeah, there's a lot of idiotic arguments among teenagers. But that's a good segue, because I wanted to ask you about, so you were saved at some point. Is that the terminology you use?
Yeah, I mean, I think that terminology can carry some baggage with it, so yeah. I don't use that too often. But yeah, That's the idea that is communicated in the Bible, that there is a rescuing or a saving that happens.
So there was some moment that you went from being nominally religious to experiencing religion.
Or, yes, for sure.
When was that?
Yeah. So during my high school years, I don't know how much of this story you want, but during my high school years, I was struggling with a lot of things that, you know, typical teenagers struggle with, you know, peer pressure to, you know, get involved with drugs and alcohol, that sort of thing, and was experimenting with that, and, you know, that pressure to, you know, fit in, and the pressure to want to be popular, to feel like somebody. And in that, you know, just continued down this road of just not being very happy during my high school years. And I just always kind of sensed that something was missing in my life, that I just didn't feel like things were flourishing in my life. I struggled academically, those sorts of things.
So growing up, I mean, you went to church regularly?
I did growing up. And then about when I was in junior high, I really didn't want to go to church anymore. You know, I'd go here and there with my parents, but a lot of times I would just, you know, when I was old enough to just stay home, I remember times I'd stay home from going to church.
How did your parents react to that?
They always tried to encourage me to go, but I don't remember them coming down on me too hard about it or anything like that.
Yeah, there is kind
my
of
parents
a...
weren't ones, you know, they were regular church attenders, but weren't really rigid about it.
Do you have siblings?
I do. I have an older sister. She's 4 years older than me, and a older brother as well. He's 2 years older than me.
Are they both still religious?
Yeah, I'd say so. Yeah, they're both attend churches. My brother's family, he and his family live in the Seattle area, and they attend church regularly. My brother was actually the one who began to really explain the Bible more to me when I was first you know, during those high school years that I was struggling with.
So did you have a moment when, well, you know, I could call it being saved or whatever, but is there that time that you can recall that you went from being Mark that was struggling with identity and peer pressure and all that to Mark who had a relationship with Jesus Christ?
Yeah, I mean, I can't pinpoint an exact date. I know some Christians will be able to tell you it was on June 21st, 1993.
They can tell you where they were and what was on the radio and
exactly.
Everything else, yeah.
But mine was sometime during my senior year of high school. It was during that year that, you know, I was just experiencing some depression, some struggles, you know, with fitting in, some academic problems in high school, and it was then that my brother became, you know, he was really growing in his faith. He had gone away to college at Utah State University and was involved with a group, a campus ministry there, and was really growing in his faith. And he would come home on the weekends, I remember, and he would bring friends home a lot of times, his college buddies. And I remember just seeing them interact with one another, and it was in this loving way that I hadn't seen among how I was treating other people. And my brother just really had a really good relationship with my parents, and I was kind of struggling as the rebellious teenager with my parents, and so I was seeing something different in his life and was really gravitated toward it. Although, you know,
were you
I wouldn't
kind of
have said
the bad kid
the
with the rebellion, or did your other siblings go through similar periods?
I was sort of the rebellious one of the three of us. I mean, they were, you know, I'm sure they had their issues, but definitely I was probably considered the rebellious one. If any of us were that rebellious, I don't know, you know.
So you never, like, answered the altar call or anything, or you weren't praying and had the moment or whatever it was? You just kind of, what do you say, over a period of maybe a few weeks or months, you just kind of transitioned?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question, because when my brother was talking to me about who really the essence of who Jesus was, the essence of what salvation means biblically, it was during that time that I remember picking up the Bible, and I had opened it up a few times in the past, and really it never resonated with me. But I remember during my senior year sometime of, I started reading the Gospel of Matthew in the New Testament, and I remember being blown away. Like, this person, Jesus, is doing amazing things, serving, doing all these, you know, healing people, gravitating toward the poor, and that he was crucified. And I remember being blown away by this, and I couldn't put the book down. Like, I remember reading it. I read the Gospel of Matthew in one night, and then after that, you know, it was sort of gradual, but I just remember I had this desire to just read and try to discover more of who Jesus was.
So at some point growing up, Book of Mormon must have come into your hands.
Yeah.
They're everywhere. Did you ever open that up and try?
I did, a little bit. I'm a little ashamed to say this, but, you know, during my kind of early years of first becoming a Christian in Utah, you know, I was around other Christians who we would always look for ways to disprove Mormonism or whatever. So I kind of looked at the Book of Mormon with that lens.
Yeah. Well, that's another thing I was going to ask you, because I know some of the Christian churches around Utah do, I mean, it's not the only axe they've got to grind, but a lot of them do spend some time and sort of, I would not call it anti-Mormon apologetics, but counter-Mormon apologetics. Did Mormonism come up much in church? Or, because I also know some churches, like yours, for example, doesn't come up. There's nothing to talk about there, you know. That's not what you're about, is, you know, grinding that axe.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting question, because being in Utah, it's interesting that in terms of like in one of the public gatherings of any church that I've been in, when there's more than just a few people present, Mormonism doesn't come up very often. Maybe in, you know, a smaller kind of Sunday school class, Mormonism gets discussed a little bit because of the context that we're living in. But in terms of like a public worship service, something that would be along the lines of the sacrament meeting for Mormons, in that kind of setting, Mormonism really doesn't come up, at least the churches I've been to.
Yeah. I know that, I forget the guy's name, but the pastor of Cavalry Baptist here in town.
Yeah, France Davis.
It's on the tip of my tongue, but he does a daily radio kind of sermon thing. And every once in a while, he'll talk a little bit about Mormon apologetics. But, you know, because Cavalry Baptist is probably the biggest Protestant operation here, I think, at least in terms of their presence. I mean, they've got a radio show anyway.
Oh, probably Calvary Chapel.
Yeah. Maybe that's it. I forget the guy's name. Road Home is the name of their radio show. But I also know that there's some smaller ones that I've encountered. I've seen their tracks and stuff that, you know, for them, it's a bigger thing about, you know, let's go save the Mormons, or at least let's go fight with the Mormons. But, yeah. So high school, at some point you went off to seminary. When was that?
Well, I started my seminary experience in 2000. I started in the Masters of Divinity program at seminary, which is a 3 to 4 year master's degree. I started that back in 2000. I did 1 year of the degree then, but financially I just couldn't continue at that point.
No scholarships to the seminary?
Right. I mean, I got some scholarship, but the seminary was very conscious about students going from seminary into the ministry probably aren't going to make a ton of money, so they kind of limited the loans that you could take out.
What school did you go to?
I went to Covenant Theological Seminary. It's in St. Louis, Missouri.
And is there a particular denomination or organization that oversees them?
Yeah, it's the National Seminary for the Presbyterian Church in America, which is the denomination that I'm a pastor in.
Okay. And to back up, though, so when did you decide to go to seminary? Or did you have other career ideas out of high school? Or
I did. Well, yeah, I did. After high school, I really didn't know in the beginning what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to go to college, but I was a little anxious about whether I would be accepted anywhere, and I But I did start did a year at Weber State University before transferring to the University of Nebraska, where I studied sociology.
Oh.
And it was the first time that I always struggled in high school because I just didn't have enough interest in something, I think. But when I went to college and was able to kind of gravitate and focus in on one area of study, that was sociology that really excited me. And from there, I wasn't sure, what do you do with a sociology degree besides pursue more school or teach? But while I was at the University of Nebraska, I was involved in another campus ministry there that got me really excited about doing ministry. And I thought about doing, you know, pursuing full-time vocational kind of ministry post-college.
So did you feel like you got the call?
Not at that point, no. I mean, from there I moved to Chicago, and I had met some people who were doing urban ministry on the west side of Chicago in a African-American neighborhood, lower-income neighborhood on Chicago's west side, and it was attractive to me because I've always been attracted to cultures that are different than mine, and I wanted to immerse myself and learn in this culture. So I started volunteering with this urban ministry, but, you know, was seeking a way to pay my bills. And so did a couple of jobs in Chicago. I worked in a group home with teens who had been either removed from their homes or, you know, in situations where, abandonment, that sort of thing. And they were in group homes that I worked in, and also worked at Moody Bible Institute, overseeing the resident hall front desk operations there. It was an administrative type of position, but from there really wanted to get, you know, more kind of personal in a job where I had more personal contact with people rather than administrative. And I wanted to work more with either college students or adults. And so I, you know, moved out from Chicago and started working at a school in Indiana as a resident director at a university in Indiana, Indiana Wesleyan University. It was a Christian based university.
At what point in all this did you meet your wife?
So following that first year at Covenant Seminary, I was kind of broke, didn't know what I was going to do to try to get my feet back on the ground. And my parents were back here. They had, in the meantime, moved from Layton to Centerville, and they were in Centerville. And I didn't know what else to do, so I moved.
You didn't have where to lay your head?
That's right. I was 31 then. And I moved into my parents' basement, so it was a little bit, it was a little bit difficult.
After 1 year of seminary, and then at that point you didn't know how or if or why or where you were going to continue.
Right, right.
That's got to be depressing.
It was. It was a little bit depressing.
Did you have any struggles with God?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah, that was probably one of the times I struggled the most with God. Like, why would you, in a sense, you know, what I felt like was somewhat of a calling. You know, I had a desire to pursue, you know, understanding, getting a better understanding of the Bible. And I go to this place, I tried to work hard, in terms of academics and, trying to pursue a better understanding of who God was. And at the end of the year, I struggled. I've had a hard time with languages, learning languages, and I struggled with trying to learn Greek, which the New Testament was written in originally.
Yeah, we all got to learn Greek. And it's not even useful Greek. It's a Greek that nobody speaks anymore except for Bible students.
Exactly, yeah. And so it was hard. And I definitely was asking questions like, where are you, God, in this?
How are your parents about all this? I mean, they must have been really happy when you took off to seminary, but then you came back and everything's all, you know, I mean, obviously they took you in and all that, but how are they about all this?
Yeah, my parents have always been pretty gracious and compassionate with me. You know, they kind of felt for me, like, wow, you know, you were pursuing this and, you know, ended up not being able to continue. And so they were, I mean, they were just compassionate. You know, they said, come stay with us for a while till you get your feet on the ground.
Did they say anything about, you know, you should go back and finish or you should try something else? Or do they pretty much stay out of your way about that?
They've always kind of stayed out of my way about it. And they've always encouraged me with whatever I pursued. You know, I was pursuing some other jobs at that time versus going back to school immediately just so I could save up to continue one day.
So that was, I mean, so that was the plan. Obviously, you ended up back in seminary.
I did, yeah.
And so that's that how you after, did it? You just kind of, you saved up some money and went back?
Well, after moving back to Utah, I met a friend of Melissa's, who Melissa's now.
Oh, that's right. That was
my wife. Yeah. And I started working at the University of Utah delivering mail. Just wanted to find a job here that would, you know, where I could at least have a job to make a little money and try to save up to then pursue seminary again. And in the meantime, I met Melissa and.
Cause she was also raised in Utah, right?
She was. She was raised in Ogden.
And also never Mormon, or never Mo, as we call them. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, her parents were transplants from Michigan, and she was brought up in the Christian Reformed Church, which is, one of those denominations that a lot of people ask, what is Christian Reformed? Reformed from what?
Do you know, did she catch any trouble growing up? The whole,
you know what, her, she didn't, like, she had a great experience growing up, and her parents, they live in a neighborhood that's probably 90%, you know, 80 to 90% LDS, I would guess, in Washington Terrace and the Ogden area. And like virtually everybody on their block is LDS. But they've got this great relationship with everybody. And, you know, most people know that they're not LDS but still have this respect for one another. And Melissa, I mean, her experience was great growing up.
Wow. So it is possible. Mormons and Christians can get along.
I think so. I hope so. I mean, that's pretty sad if we can't.
So had you married her by the time you went back to seminary?
Yeah. So,
I imagine that probably was a big help getting through seminary.
Yeah, it was. I mean, so after coming back, I'd met Melissa, but then I was in the midst of pursuing getting back to the Midwest and, had found a job in Chicago again and moved back there. But Melissa and I continued a long distance relationship and lots of phone conversations and flying back and forth, back when you could buy a plane ticket between, here and Chicago for, under $200. Yeah. And so we were flying back and forth, quite a bit. And then, I was working in a job that I didn't see a future in, and Melissa was working at the Road Home here in Salt Lake City. And she has a social work background and was really, you know, she liked what she was doing. So I decided to move back and marry her. She was here in sort of her career path, and I wasn't really doing what I wanted to do. And I loved Chicago, but, I moved back to marry her. Wow. I loved her more than Chicago, for sure.
So how did you end up back in seminary?
During our first few years of marriage, first couple of years, I was just working two jobs, saving money. Melissa was finishing up a social work degree at the University of Utah. We got to a place where just financially, we were at a place where it was made sense to make that jump back to me going into seminary full time.
So she liked that idea too, of you going back.
She did. She loves Utah, so much that it was really, really hard for her to leave. I mean, she had gone away to college in the Los Angeles area. So she has had experiences outside of Utah, but she really loved this place. She really still does love Utah. And so it was much harder for her to, I was used to kind of getting up and, you know, moving wherever the wind blew, you know, so, but much harder for her, but, you know, we worked through that. And when we moved to St. Louis for me to pursue seminary, it was definitely difficult first year, for her particularly, it was a good experience.
So you did 3 more years of school there, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
And this is one of the things I wanted to talk about that's so interesting, comparing it to Mormonism, is that in Mormonism, you can't aspire to leadership. If you're aspiring to leadership, then you need to check where your soul's at. Uh-huh. And this whole idea that, like, I want to be a pastor, I feel this calling to go and do this thing, and so I'm going to work hard and pay my way through a school, at the end of which there's no guarantee or whatever. Whereas in Mormonism, you know, you're tapped. You are called to be a bishop, and then you're a bishop. And, you know, if you're the spouse of a bishop, that's just dumped on you, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas in your case, it's this completely opposite thing where you and your wife are working together to this goal that you want to accomplish, and you don't even know how it's going to work out in the end. It's such a stark thing. And one of the big criticisms of Mormonism is that because bishops are basically just tapped to be bishops, more often than not, they have zero training when it comes to most of the things that you'd consider pastoral things do, like, you know, counseling or just giving advice or things like that. And, you know, so, I mean, Mormons have all these gajillions of stories of jackass bishops doing unbelievably stupid things. Whereas, like, in your case, like, you go to a university and this is the whole purpose is learning to do this thing.
Yeah.
Which is pastoring, I guess. So, like, you end up with a master's degree in divinity, which means what? You know a lot about the Bible?
Yeah, the master's of divinity involves theological studies, biblical studies, the biblical languages, counseling courses, pastoral ministry courses, leadership courses. It's comprehensive. That's why it's a three to four year.
Imagine there's probably also classes on like paperwork and taxes and how to file. Like, I mean, that's the thing. It's like you created a church. We're going to get to that later, but like.
Right. Well, that's the thing that I've kind of had to learn on my own is, you know, a lot of the, you know, how do you start a nonprofit? Because that's basically what you're doing.
Yeah.
Starting a nonprofit, it's basically like starting a business in a lot of ways. And that kind of training, you don't really get at seminary. I mean, it's 102 credit hour master's degree, but that's a lot of stuff packed in.
Yeah.
That's why it's so extensive, you know, in terms of the credit hours. But it doesn't involve how to start a business.
I would have thought they would have had some kind of advice on just church planting, as they call it.
Yeah, but, I mean, there's resources for that out there that I have lots of access to. But yeah,
and so I'm sure part of it obviously is the Bible. And I know from talking to you before, they at least touched on or discussed like issues of higher criticism, you know, and also just other theological things. I can't remember what I was having a conversation with you and. I've said something about docetism, and you said you hadn't heard that word since seminary, but you heard it, right?
Because
that's
correct.
Another thing that Mormons all think that they are scriptorians. None of them are, you know, because they just read what they tell you to do. But not only did you guys read the Bible and have the perspective of the Presbyterian organization you had, but you guys also discussed other theological views and things like that, right?
Yeah, sure. Especially the ones that have been prominent in history in terms of, you know, where some of the historic creeds come from and what they were refuting at those times. You know, we got a lot of that.
Yeah, see, for Mormons, it's just like, oh, it's a bunch of apostates, unless one of the church fathers says something that we like and which we go, oh, see, a little bit of the gospel snuck through, we can tell, you know. But then everything else they say, oh, well, that's just, you know, satanic, whore of all the earth, demonic lies.
Yeah.
So you graduated from the seminary and it's not like they give you a church, right? How does that work?
Right. So graduated from the seminary, from Covenant Theological Seminary. And really, I mean, in a lot of ways, Presbyterian Church in America is what's considered a grassroots denomination, which it's not top down. I was explaining this to someone, talking about this with somebody else that was, I don't know if it was you the other day or somebody else that knew about the structure of the Mormon Church, but it's very, you know, it's very, very much from from the bottom up in some ways versus top-down kind of structure. And so you graduate from seminary, and it's sort of up to you to pursue what's next.
The world's out there.
World's out there. It's, you know, you definitely have some tools to work with at that point after seminary, because you've networked a bit more. You've gotten, the seminary provides resources in terms of like where there are available jobs for pastors, those sorts of things.
But that's all just suggestions. Like, that's another thing that's dead opposite of Mormonism, is that if some Mormon comes to the bishop and says, you know what, I think that I need to go to Harlem and, you know, work with homeless people or whatever, they'd be like, well, that's neat. God actually just wants you to, you know, conduct the choir. You know, it's all just obedience, obedience, obedience. This idea that, like, there's nothing that you can really, in Mormonism, the things that you can aspire to, you're told what you can aspire to or what service you're going to do, you know, like the missions thing. You get called to where you get called. And like, for me, it was this really confusing thing, because I thought for sure I was going to learn another language, because I just had this natural thing with languages. Fascinated by them. I wanted to go to the weirdest, wildest culture in the world, and they send me to Northern California to speak English. The only thing that's different about Northern California is they call almonds almonds. That's all the language I had to learn. So, because talking about this church planning thing, when I met you, you formed the church that met at the coffee shop that I was at all the time.
Yeah.
Which was something that just fascinated me from the get-go. Because for one thing, the owner of the coffee shop, I know, is an atheist ex-Mormon. Uh-huh. You know, but how did you make that arrangement anyway? I don't even know. Like, you just asked Joe, can I have a church here on Sunday?
This is great. Like, I mean, they've been so, No Brow Coffee has just been so amazingly hospitable to us. So real quick,
important news for ex-Mormons. The best coffee in town is at No Brow. No Brow Coffee Works. Look it up and just go in there and ask for Joe, and he'll tell you anything you wanted to know about coffee.
Pretty amazing.
And he was more, I've known Joe since high school, so we're talking about old friends here. Yeah. But so, yeah, you asked Joe about the church.
So, yeah, when I came back to Salt Lake City, you know, I had interned while I was here before going back the second time to Covenant. I had interned here with a church, with New Song Presbyterian Church. It's on the east side of Salt Lake. But after seminary, I had kept my connection with them, and they had asked me if I wanted to pursue being an assistant pastor with them. The senior pastor there, Sam Wheatley, contacted me and said he knew I was searching for a call following seminary, and he said, well, why don't you commit to being back here in Salt Lake and helping us out for 3 years? And so I came back as an assistant pastor to him at New Song Presbyterian Church, and through that, as an assistant pastor, I knew 6 months into it that I'm the kind of person that loves to kind of start things, and I liked being an assistant pastor, but was really kind of longing to do what we call church planting, and that is to start a new church, start a new congregation. And
yeah, see, that's something that's completely foreign to Mormonism. Like, the entire globe is geographically divided already. Like, whether there's a church there or not, you're in a ward or a branch or a district or something anywhere on the planet, according to Mormonism. There's no church planting to do other than, you know, to move in and start converting people. The way they see it, the whole world is already waiting for us, you know, which is just bizarre. So, yeah, and getting back to No Brow, the first little church you started.
Yeah, so I started pursuing, well, I was just hanging out at No Brow, and I loved it, and, you know, it was a place where I could go and meet up with people, but then also work on sermons or, you know, prepare for whatever.
It's a pretty secular place.
Yeah.
And it gets a little bawdy in there from time to time.
Yeah.
A little blue.
Yeah.
But somehow you've stuck around.
Yeah. I mean, it's been a great community for me to be involved in and build some great relationships there. You know, one day I just asked Joe, I said, you know, I had this dream of like, so the church I'm planting now is called, it's called City Presbyterian, Salt Lake. And our mission, what we are about is that we're a Central Salt Lake City church that strives to make public the life-changing love of Christ. And we take make public very seriously. And so I have always dreamed about starting a church in a coffee shop because I like the idea of interacting with our culture, of engaging people in dialogue about religious belief, but also learning from people in the midst of the marketplace.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's no other way. I mean, any other time I'm going to meet a pastor, it's going to be at a church, and that's just meeting a person. Like, the fact that I know you and that we're friends is simply to your credit of just being around. There's not a lot of Christian pastors hanging around Nobrow. You're the only one, but you're out there. And that's the thing is that, you know, a lot of the guys at Nobrow I know, most of them are, you know, some kind of secular. Most of them had some kind of religion growing up, and most of them want nothing to do with religion. And yet they all like and respect you, and you add to the coffee shop. Nobody wants to see you go. They love that you're there, you know, because it really does. Also, it kind of makes it the most hipster place in Utah because, look, we've got Christians.
That's right. Yeah.
I remember the very early days of Nobrow, Sunday nights. You had the little church in there with just, you know, maybe 5 or 6 people at the start. Yeah. And I went to church with you a couple of times because I had to see what it was. And it was really interesting to see. Like, I mean, you had a little communion and it was all, you know, super small.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, I'm not a religious person, but it was a lot more churchy. It was a lot more of what the things church should be than what I experienced, you know. Like, I mean, big joke among ex-Mormons, sacrament meeting is called shareholder meeting because it really almost just sounds like a big, boring business meeting.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that we wanted to do, too, is like, as a minority faith in Utah, We expect that there's going to be people who, you know, are either from a religious LDS perspective that are skeptical of who we are, what we do, but then you have ex-LDS or people who are totally unfamiliar with a church community who might be skeptical as well. And so what we were seeking to do and still do in our philosophy is we want to be as public as possible in order to kind of break down some of these walls of skepticism that people might have with religious people or with Christian people. And that's why I sought Joe. And I just asked him one day, Joe, what do you think about, what if we met here, you know, and had a church service in the coffee shop? I just threw it out there. And he didn't hesitate. He was like, oh, that'd be great. He's like, what we could do is we close at 6 o'clock. But you guys can start at 6:30. We'll just keep the doors open to the public, which is what we wanted. We want to interact with the public. And he says, you know, I'll get back with you after I find out if I can staff it, if I can have a barista here on Sunday nights who'd be willing to stay. And a couple days later, he got back to me and he was like, you guys can meet here.
That was the whole arrangement.
Yeah.
And you kept that up for a few years, right?
Yeah, we did. We had that group. We had that group going on Sunday nights, and then we had a few families involved that had toddlers, and it wasn't too conducive for them to meet at a coffee shop later in the evening on Sunday night. And so we started another group at the Central City Rec Center on Saturday mornings, mid-morning, where we used their playground and you know, had a, you know, the adults had a Bible study, and the kids were occupied with playing and then this past December, just a few months ago, we brought these two groups together and started our first Sunday morning worship service.
Yeah, I'm glad we got there because I was trying to get to there. Because I know from just hanging around all these years, some of the people that were at the Nobrow Church from the very beginning are still with you.
Yeah.
And, you know, the crowd's grown quite a bit. And so, I mean, Nobrow's moved since then.
We're still small, though.
Yeah, but that's what I was getting to next, is I went to church with you, the Palm Sunday, week before last, which is the first time I'd been to the new church, which meets in that kind of warehouse of the Local First Utah?
Yeah, Local First Utah has their offices there, but they have a warehouse space that's also their offices in a warehouse.
Yeah. And so they're accommodating you there, and I don't know what that arrangement is, but I remember at church you said something very interesting, that you talked about how even though the people that run Local Utah First might not be religious necessarily, that, yeah, I can't remember the wording you said, but, you know, it's an expression of God's love that they open the church, or open their building up to let you have church, which is like this interesting thing that, you brought up several times, is how you see God working everywhere, not mm-hmm. just in the body of Christ, as it were. You know, you mentioned before that Joe, because like Joe was an atheist, but he let you have church there, and the people that run Utah First, you know, whatever their issues are, but they let you have church there, which is, again, very, very different from Mormonism. Like, in the Mormon paradigm, non-Mormons who do good things are basically doing it by accident, or because God made them for his purposes or whatever, you know? It's not really, God can't work through wicked people except to do wicked things, you know, whatever. But, so church, at your church, this is some of the things that I noticed that I have to bring up. Coffee, and not just any coffee, the best coffee in Utah.
Yeah, we saw.
And there was bagels.
Charming Beard from Nobrow.
Yeah.
Or Blue Copper. Which
all very ultra-fine coffee. There was coffee there, and bagels, which was so great, because, and even though your church was only an hour, you had bagels, because one of the great mysteries of Mormonism for me is that they want you in church on Sunday for 3 hours, and they want you there at 9 a.m., and there's no way in hell that you're going to get the kids fed and dressed. And I just remember as a kid, and even as an adult, you're just starving. And the thing is, the sacrament is a little cup of water and a little square of Wonder Bread, which is just like, just gets your appetite going, because you think, you know, it feels like eating, except it's not. And there's no theological, doctrinal, no reason at all they couldn't have a 15-minute break to have a bagel and a cup of hot chocolate or something, but they just are so intransigent.
Yeah, one of my favorite theologians, N.T. Wright, says, you know, on Easter we ought to have champagne at church, and I almost did that this past Easter, but I didn't, because I'm trying to, you know, I really want to be conscious of people who struggle with alcohol.
Well, because then
for sure, but
the, and in the sacrament itself that you did, or the communion, I thought was interesting is that the accoutrements you have are tasteful and understated, which is again to contrast with Mormonism. It's all just this cold steel, ugly things, you know. And this is the thing that's kind of weird. Mormons have this whole thing where they like when other religions do things that are like ostentatious or gaudy. They get all uppity and say, like, oh, Catholics, golden thread robes, all that crap. And yet they have, you know, their temples and all that stuff where they go all out. But I really liked the way you do the communion just because it looked, it's got a little bit of ceremony to it. You got a lovely little wooden tray, and it's still got the little plastic cups, but also you had wine and grape juice. Which again, like, I mean, the wine thing is out of the Mormonism now, which is silly, because if you read the Word of Wisdom, it expressly, the only reason you can make wine is for sacrament, so I don't know why we can't do that. But, like, Mormons would just say, like, well, it's not about that. Well, of course it's not about that, but it helps, you know, the fact, and also that the piece of bread you've got is a nice piece of bread, like a nice crafted loaf, instead of crappy Wonder Bread that you actually tear apart right there. It was nice. Yeah. And it made the whole communion thing just, because, you know, Mormon is the whole point of sacrament meeting. That's the culmination of weekly service, is you take the sacrament and renew your covenants. But it is such a robotic thing for Mormons, you know? Like, the sacrament prayer is one of the very, very few things in Mormonism that's rote. It's the same every time. And for decades, the 16-year-olds have this exact cadence that they say it every time, the same way. And it's just this dour thing. And I'm going on too long about this. But at your service, it was like this lovely thing. Because then you just kind of got up and you, off the cuff, you talked a little bit about the sacrament, the communion, what it's about and all that. And it was so much more pleasant. And it also went a lot faster.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you thought it was pleasant. Yeah.
It's
one of my favorite parts of the service.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, I'm an atheist. I don't believe in any of it. And I kind of have issues with the whole idea of atonement, but I get what it means to people who believe in it, and it is beautiful. It is a wonderful idea, and, you know, I think it's a positive thing for people to meditate on, and the way that your communion goes was a lot better. I'm trying to think of all the other things about your church that I thought was so great. One thing, like I said, it's only an hour. Well, now it's something else. At the Easter brunch that you invited me to after that on the next Saturday, which was lovely, thanks, we were talking about your church and the timing of it. And you mentioned that you're thinking about moving it to 10 a.m. from 11 a.m. because after talking to the congregants, You feel that if you got it out of the way a little earlier, people wouldn't feel like church took up the whole day. And I actually had this moment in my brain, like my still Mormon brain had like hit a brick wall where I was like, whoa, church doesn't have to take up the whole day.
Yeah.
And that you actually recognize this idea, because that was, you come to church in the morning, get your dose of Jesus, and then get on with your life and hang out with your family and do the things you want to do. It's another classic thing in Mormonism is that Sunday is just a dead day for Mormons. Because usually, for one thing, after sacrament, you're just drained, or not after sacrament, after the 3 hours of church. If you're lucky, you've only got 3 hours. If you're a good Mormon, you're probably doing more.
Yeah, well,
and you're just so drained. And I remember, like, you come home and nobody wants to talk to anybody else just because everybody's just bitter or whatever. And I like that your church is like this nice little dose. Oh, also the music, an electric bass and a guitar. Nothing raucous. There was no drums and it was an acoustic guitar.
We would like to get a djembe or something going, but we need someone that plays the drums. So if there's anyone out there who wants to play the drums.
You know what I recommend for you is a cajon. Have you seen those? It's a little stool. It's a Mexican thing.
You
sit on it, and it's a percussion instrument, and it's perfect for your kind of thing because it's not hideously loud. But the music was generally nice, although I know that you can't answer this, but it's something that I've been wondering forever, is what is up with contemporary Christian worship music and suspended chords?
You got me. You got me.
I have a couple of theories, and one is that suspended chords are kind of question-asking chords, because in musical theory, they're unresolved. But the other theory is that they just kind of sound rich and shimmery and kind of give everything kind of a veneer of, it makes it not rock and roll, basically.
Yeah.
But anyway, just listen to the music, because it was all music I'd never heard before, and I kind of went in going like, is it going to be all suspended chords? It was.
Well, one of the things we try to do, and if you were... So that particular service was probably a lot more contemporary than some of our services, and we tried to do a mix.
Yeah, like, I know from the older ones you've did some of the class. I think I've heard hymns I recognize, that Mormons kind of still sing.
Yeah, we try to probably we usually do two hymns that are traditional hymns, and then two contemporary or two or three hymns or two or three contemporary and. Mix it up, just because we know people are attracted to different things, and not that we're trying to be attractional or just attract people, but history is moving forward, and we recognize that we want to be a church that's rooted in that has some sort of historical roots, but that we're also moving forward because that's what the Bible is about. It's a story that moves forward from creation to a future city.
Well, it's the contrast is that, and this is a common thing that, that evangelicals say about Mormons is that Mormons sort of worship the church more than they worship Jesus, which I know, Mormons get really upset at that, but it's a viewpoint that can make sense. And that the way that you do it is that this whole thing is just the framework of getting to Jesus. And you can change that. Like, it doesn't have to be this way or that way, as long as we're doing the Jesus thing, which is refreshing. Part of the reason I bring this all up is that in the Mormon expression world, it's mostly secular, and a lot of, the ex-Mormons that I associate with are mostly secular atheists, and a lot of us get this idea that most people leave Mormonism and become atheists. But as many that become secular go find religion somewhere else, and usually Christian religion. And while I'm not generally in the business of recommending churches, there's a lot of things. Like, if you left Mormonism and you still want a dose of Jesus, you can do a lot worse than Pastor Mark's church, because the things that you care about when it comes to, if you want to have faith in Christ, you can get that and plenty from you, and you don't have to do any of the crap that you hated with Mormonism. There's no, you don't join your church, right? You just show up, right? You don't keep records or anything.
Right, we have membership, yeah, but, it's not like you become worthy to become a member.
You're not overly concerned with, obviously you'd like to grow, but your primary focus isn't growth.
Right, in terms of numbers. Yeah, I want to see people know Jesus, people grow in their faith and their understanding of who God is, but also grow in their personal growth, become people who love God and love people. I mean, that's what we're about, is loving God, loving people, loving our city, and serving our city. We want to see Salt Lake City become more and more beautiful. We want to see oppression and racism and inequality go away.
Yeah.
And we want to see people encouraged in who they are and loved upon, you know, and we want to see this place become more and more beautiful, more and more creative. We want to, you know, we encourage things like the arts, and, you know, yeah. That's why I love hanging out at Nobrow. For one of the reasons is because, you know, it's a place where people in our city who are pursuing different, you know, artistic expressions or whatever, they hang out there. So I want to be in the midst of that. And, you know, as a pastor, I want to foster that as much as possible. You know, I don't know always what the answer is to how I can do that. Part of what I do, part of my job, is just coming alongside people, listening and encouraging, and certainly pointing people toward who Christ is. But, you know, it's more than that, too.
Well, yeah, see, for Mormons, like, the way that you, if you're a Mormon and you want to make the world a better place, the thing that you do is you pay your tithing and you go to church and let the brethren, because, you know, the church is going to save the world or whatever, right? You know, they're led by God and they know exactly how a society should function and all that. And, you know, they don't necessarily frown on extracurricular activism or anything like that. But, you know, they'd consider it auxiliary, you know. For them, like a lot of Mormons, for them, charity is paying their tithing. The way they see it, that's the best way you could spend your money, is to pay your tithing to the church, because the church is the only organization on earth that's capable of doing anything meaningful. Where, again, you've got this ground-up thing where, like, people come to your church. Like, you've mentioned you've got a garden, community garden thing going now.
Yeah, so we have one of the plots at the People's Portable Garden, a Wasatch Community Gardens plot, right there at the corner of 200 South, or 200 West and 900 South.
Yeah, see, and a couple of weeks ago, they were talking about on the podcast how the church has, like, onion farms down in Utah County, and that they intentionally let the weeds get out of control so that the local wards have service projects they can come do.
Wow.
Whereas, like, I've seen from your churches, like, hey, there's some garbage, let's go pick it up. Who wants to come pick it up with me? Or whatever it is, you know?
Yeah.
It's this self-starter thing. It's a whole different thing.
Well, yeah. And again, I mean, we are just seeking to be involved in the city and serve in any way we can. I mean, part of earlier you talked about how you put it, but talking about how it was back to the local First Utah. Like, we recognize that their hospitality is, how did I put it?
An expression of God's love.
An expression of God's love. And, you know, this is going into some theology, but we have this theological premise of, we believe everybody's made in the image of God, whether, regardless of what they believe. And so everybody's worthy of respect and dignity, and we seek to encourage that. And so we want to serve, you know, people who believe totally different than us, and encourage in their lives to be, you know, that's part of what we're called. Jesus you know, came to not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. And we're seeking, you know, and we don't do it great sometimes, and we do it with motives that aren't, you know, completely unselfish, but that's what we're striving for.
Well, that's brilliant. The thing I asked you before, if you had many ex-Mormons in the congregation, and I was disappointed because you had to think about it and thought maybe one, because I was hoping there'd be lots. But
yeah.
It was also interesting to me because, like, while we've already pretty well established, you're not the ex-grinding kind of Christian, but here you are in Utah, in Salt Lake City, planting a church. But you certainly, I've never seen you do, like, Mormon-specific evangelism, because that's a big thing here. I know there's, mm-hmm. I forget who it is, I think it might be the Cavalry guys again, but they have, once a year, they have an annual convention, I've been to it, where it's how to evangelize the Mormons.
Right.
Whereas, you know, for you, it's just, if the Mormons want to come, great, and if they don't, well, God bless you. Because I've asked you before if I'm going to hell, and you don't know, right?
Yeah, I don't know with certainty. I
assume the same thing goes for Mormons. You don't know if the Mormons are going to hell.
The way I put it is, Okay, what the Bible says is the Bible clearly communicates that those who experience eternal life, life in relationship with God, that experience heaven, are those who put their hope and faith in Jesus Christ.
No, no, because you got to know the signs and tokens.
And so, you know, and overall, I believe God is a gracious God who doesn't try to hide from people. And so I recognize that, you know, that even if I don't believe theologically what Mormonism says, I believe that there's people in the Mormon church that have faith in Christ and are, again, using that term, saved, you know, have been rescued, because it's not our doing, you know, and that's back to theology, you know. We need a savior because we're incapable of saving ourselves. We're incapable of being worthy. I can't make myself worthy, and I can't make myself this wonderful human being. I've been affected by sin, you know, by sin has disrupted every aspect. This is theologically what I believe, that sin or this turning away from God has brought about a disruption of our world, in which not only we as human beings are affected by sin, but the entire creation, and we have systems, you know, that are affected by sin. You know, we have systemic racism, you know, these sort of things where the whole creation has been disrupted. But God's a God who is renewing our world. And the primary way that he does that is he renews people. He rescues people in terms of bringing them into a relationship with God through Jesus Christ. But we are, it's not our own worthiness that puts us in a good position with God.
Mormons feel the exact same way, that, you know, I can never be worthy. But the difference is that you're still supposed to try, you know? And it's a total nonsensical thing. Because I remember talking to you a long time ago about the famous grace versus works, you know, which is, I guess, next to the nature of godhood, number two on the list of irreconcilable theological differences between Mormons and evangelicals. And I remember talking to you about it, you know, I listen to the evangelical talk radio and listen to them sermonize and also listen to them do their counter-Mormon apologetics. And, you know, this whole idea of, like in Mormonism, you do good things because you have faith in Christ. And Christ, you know, part of having faith in Christ is Christ commands you to do good things. And so you show your faith by doing good works. And then in the evangelical thing, with the grace, you can't do anything good by yourself. You can only, you know, Christ, whatever it is. And, the reason that Christians, once you're saved, that you do good things is that you're full of the light of Christ. And, you know, like I remember saying before, like you can inverse them. You can inverse them, reverse them, and you kind of get in the same place, you know. It's like two sides of the same coin. Or it's like in the way that an electric motor and an electric generator are the exact same thing, just running in opposite directions, if that makes sense, you know. So, like, you don't have this idea like a lot of people, Christians do, that, you know, the Mormons are in darkness. And that, you know, they're swimming out there and they're incapable of, you know, again, like, it's, I guess, the same kind of idea the Mormons have, that if you do something moral, it was by accident and not because of Christ or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, the way I theologically read the Bible is that Christians, who we are, is we're people who respond to grace. We respond to a free gift of salvation that we didn't earn. And it's out of that gratitude and living out of thankfulness and gratitude that we then pursue trying to live out the laws that are presented in the Bible. And it's out of a gratitude. It's out of a thankfulness for what God's done in our lives. So even if you came to our service and you probably noticed this, that we have this, you know, we have sort of these in our liturgy, this call and response. So I'll say something, and that's a scriptural idea, and we respond, the congregation responds back, and it's to model this idea that we respond to God, that he calls us into a relationship with him and gives us grace and mercy that we don't deserve, and our response is out of gratitude and love that we live out the Christian life. it's not sort of the idea of testing.
Yeah.
I fail every day if life is a test.
Well, so the whole thing must be working, because back in the early days, watching you grow the church from the little no-brow thing, because there was a period of time there that I was depressed for you, just because I was just thinking like, wait, you're an evangelical pastor planting a church in the heart of Salt Lake in 2000, whatever. I just thought like, man, that's a hopeless job. But I'm surprised, honestly, how well it's been going. Like, and it's just growing. And honestly, you seem a lot happier. I mean, I don't know that you were ever unhappy, but I seem to recall, maybe just my perception, but there was a time that you seemed to be having a really hard struggle, because it seemed like it was. I mean,
I still have those days. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I mean, we're certainly not as big as a lot of churches, even in Salt Lake City. But, you know, we recognize that.
I'm not even necessarily thinking about it in terms of size, but just the participation. Because the other thing is, like, you know, very early on, and it was real quiet. Mostly you just talked and then people listened. But not that it was, you know, like a lot of back and forth or whatever. But I've just noticed that your church community is more and more community. Instead of, you know, it was kind of, you know, people here and there coming and going, but now I see more and more. I see more and more of the regular people. I'm always at No Brow at noon. I see the people coming out of church, and a lot of them come over to No Brow and kind of do the after church thing, which kind of didn't seem to be the way it was before. People kind of come in and then disperse, but you are growing this community, which was your goal. And I, you know, for a long time thought like, there's no way he's going to pull that off.
Yeah.
No,
I still have those days. It's like, how's this thing going to happen? But my wife and I, we love Utah, and we wouldn't want to be any other place. Like, we often talk, so I know a number of other church planters in Salt Lake doing similar things to what we're doing, starting new churches in a place that's not very evangelical or Protestant, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
It's, you know, and so, you know, I interact with these folks, and we recognize that this is not Georgia. Mississippi, where, you know, there's evangelicals everywhere,
yeah.
And starting a church isn't...
I think it might almost be harder to start a church in St. Louis than here, really.
Yeah, I mean, it all has its different challenges. Our challenge, you know, as a Presbyterian starting a new church in Salt Lake, has a religious element that's the particular challenge, like a prominent religious culture and, yeah. You know, pretty good sized number of people that have, left Mormonism and rejected sort of kind of Christian religion altogether. And so the challenges are huge for what some of us are doing in terms of planting new Protestant churches. So, yeah, I mean, it's definitely, I have my days where I'm not, you know, I'm discouraged or whatever, and other days where I'm excited about what's happening. When I look at the big picture, I think about so we got a small congregation of people that gather on Sunday mornings, but I look at it broader than that. Like,
I think I think I counted 18 adults and a whole bunch of kids. Also very diverse, I have to say. Very multicultural.
Yeah, that's one of the exciting things that I'm so excited
also
about.
Also, a little bit, there's a common thing in Mormonism about wards, what they call newlyweds and nearly deads. A little bit of that in your congregation.
What is that?
Some wards that they talk about not having a big diversity of population. They call them newlyweds and nearly deads.
Oh.
It's mostly about economics, but, you know, that's the thing. Like, there's the neighborhoods where everybody's retiring, and then as they die off, the young family moves in anyway.
So yeah, that's one of the things I'm most thankful for is that we ethnically we're diverse for as small a group as we are. You know, and we have, you know, some age diversity. I'd love to continue to see that fostered,
yeah.
A very multi-generational, multi-ethnic church, although we haven't set out. There are certain churches that will set out to plant a multi-ethnic church. We have just set out to look like Salt Lake City, which is 33%, last I saw, 35% non-white, which is, you know, I mean, it's not huge, but that's a significant portion of the population. So hopefully we're a church that reflects that, you know, and reflects the age differences that we see on the street. we believe this is what the church is, it's, it, you know, I'm not seeking to start a youth group. You know, I'm seeking to start a church which involves people of every kind of background coming together and worshiping Christ.
It did, I gotta say, it did seem alive. I liked that there was kids running around and then you had a little corner for the little kids. But the service, like, cause, you know, again, dogging on Mormon stuff. Mormon sacrament meetings are depressing affairs. If you look out around the room, it's just a bunch of people fighting to stay awake. And, your little church had a lot of life to it. We're running long, so we better wrap this up soon.
Okay.
But some of the things I wanted to get out. Cause, you know, the other thing that is, I'm kinda weird, a lot of ex-Mormons don't want anything to do with religion of any kind at all. For a while I had this job, for example, that I delivered medical supplies to people's homes, which one of the things I loved about it is that I got to go into people's homes. And occasionally I'd get to go into a Mormon home, and I don't know how to explain it, but it just kind of, like, I liked it. It felt like going home. I got to slip, even though we didn't talk about religion at all, I kind of slipped into that Mormon thing. I don't know how to describe it. And I got a little bit of that from going to your church and going to the brunch thing. And also, you've hosted a couple of parties that are just plain parties where there was beer and wine. And that was amazing.
And the Joshua Payne Orchestra.
And the Josh Payne Orchestra played. Yeah, you had an awesome rock band. Oh, they're not a rock band. They're better than that. But there's this thing, like the brunch thing at your house the other day, because, you know, I told the people at No Brown, so like, oh, I went, came to Mark's thing. How was it? And I was like, it was really nice. And again, it's that thing where, like, because, you know, it's not too different from any other gathering, except there was, you know, there's no alcohol and no sex humor, and, you know.
I almost had mimosas that morning, but, you know, it's Easter. We got to celebrate.
Yeah. The same thing there. Like, I just kind of looked around. I listened to the conversations. And I still like that. I mean, I'm as atheist as they come. And I try to be ecumenical, if not ecumenical. But, you know, I guess I'm not anti-religious, but I'm not pro-religious either. But there is just this thing. I don't know what it is. I guess it's because I was born and raised that way. But I like to slip into that world from time to time.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I guess that's the point. Because it's what I wanted to get out. I know a lot of people, because the other thing is that, you know, a lot of people think, you know, ooh, Christian pastor, yeah, jerk. You're the second nicest guy I've ever met.
Well, thanks.
Sorry, the nicest guy is taken by Joey. But, yeah, well, I hope this was worthwhile. I want to just kind of, again, like my sort of point with the last couple podcasts, of instead of interviewing Mormons bitching about the church, interviewing non-Mormons about religion, just to, I don't know, I guess trying to close that gap, trying to get that understanding a little bit,
because yeah.
I think still, even, you know, a lot of people leave Mormonism and they take with them a lot of the old ideas they might have had about evangelicals. Or even they might do the other thing where they just, it's like, you know, some people leave Mormonism and assume everything they ever taught was a lie. Mm-hmm. In either case, they're probably wrong about evangelicals or whatever it is, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm all about learning, finding out more about people and all that. So
yeah, part of our philosophy, too, is just that we welcome questions, you know, and
yeah, you let me ask you a lot of obnoxious questions.
We are hoping that our church just is not just made up of people, well, I mean, on one hand, we hope everyone believes and comes to faith in Christ, but on one hand, we want to be a church that, where someone who doesn't believe in God, who, you know, doesn't profess to believe and have faith in God, would feel welcomed and that their questions would be taken serious. And, you know, that's who we want to be.
You have a broader Christian mission, it seems like. Because a lot of Christians, and kind of like Mormons, where it's like the missionary, the measure of success is converting people. And, you know, and I've heard, listened to a lot of Christian radio and all that, and they do the same thing where they really push this thing that if you're not actively proselytizing and bringing people to Christ, then, you know, you need to check your faith or something. But I've heard you say a lot of things like, you know, obviously you want people to come to Christ, but that's not your only measure of success. Not
yeah,
by a long
exactly.
shot.
Here's my measure of success. Will we be missed? If we did no longer exist, would we be missed in a community? If we're not missed, there's no purpose for us being there. We want to be a church that serves to make our city better, that serves people, that loves people, that people know that when they come to City Presbyterian, somebody will listen to them and be there if they have questions. And I need that. I need that from people. I need to vent my questions, my struggles, my doubts. If you can't, if you don't have someone to voice your doubts to, that you're in a tough place.
Yeah. Well, you practice an honest religion, so I can respect that much at least. I guess we're going to wrap it up. If you don't want to be Mormon anymore, but you feel like you still need a little bit of Jesus or a little bit of Christian community, look up City Presbyterian. That's it, right? City Presbyterian?
Yeah, we're at citypresbyterian.org.
You know, worst case scenario, you get an hour at church and then you can just go get coffee and talk to atheists across the street because there's plenty of them. Just raise your hand and say, I'm an ex-Mormon, and you'll have somebody to talk to at Nobrow. But thanks so much, Mark, for doing this.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate it.
This has been a production of Whitefields Educational Foundation. Mormon Expression recently announced the Cosmic Swear Jar. If you want to contribute to Mormon Expression, but like me, you don't know how to do it responsibly, you can just say fuck and send us a buck. So that's it. Thanks, everybody.
That was awesome.
That is a swear jar. I got to go. This is how I know Mormon Expression.